You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Salt Lake City, Utah, Van Buren, Arkansas.
Is going on out there, everybody. That's right. Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And I have a treat for y'all today. Sitting across the table from me is none other than Meriwether Filson himself, the traveler, the explorer, been to the woods of Endor, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm back from my epic journey to California, Northern epic. California, with my wife. We had a great time, man. It was really interesting. And seeing the great Redwood Forest is something I've always wanted to see, probably since I saw Return of the Jedi, and I remember watching those speeder bikes. I even commented when you're driving. I showed you some of the video I took. When you're driving through the woods, I told my wife, if you're on a motorcycle, it would almost feel like you were in Endor on one of those speeder bikes. You know what I mean?
How bad did you want one of those as a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Let me rephrase that. What? How bad do you still want one of those?
Yeah. It's like a hovering jet ski or something, right?
That's exactly
with lasers on the front.
Get laser guns on it. Crazy teddy bears riding behind you and stuff. Yeah.
It was pretty cool, man. We went on a lot of hikes, and I think I saw an Ewok. I'm not sure.
Did it look squatchy up there?
Man, it totally did. And they're all about that up there because, like, on the side of the road, you'll be driving. There'll be all kinds of little booths, and everybody's trying to cash in on the Bigfoot craze, it seems like.
That's pretty cool, though.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
This was a good trip.
It was very, very fun. It's one of those things where you plan it out. You hope when you go that it's going to be fun, but you don't really know because you've never been there. Yeah. You're going to strange places. But it was perfect. We drove all over. We flew into San Francisco. We drove down to San Jose. Of course, we went to the Winchester House. Mm-hmm. If you follow us on social media, you'll see some of that. And, then we went farther south. We went down to Santa Cruz. We stayed the night there. We drove down to Monterey, went to Aquarium, stuff like that. Then we went back up north through wine country, up into Calistoga, and then up farther north, up into Humboldt County, where all the big redwoods are. We went to the Muir Woods, which is just north of San Francisco. Those redwoods were pretty good. I would suggest going there. Cheap. I mean, it's like $10 to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Miles and miles of hiking trails. If you walk one of them, you'll end up on the ocean. Nice. And then the redwoods we saw farther north were much more impressive. I mean, you can't... It doesn't look real. They're so big. I mean, seriously. And the pictures don't do it justice.
No, the video you showed me, I was telling you, I was like, this just doesn't look real. It looks...
When you're in there, in that forest, now the camera on the phone and stuff, you know, automatically adjusts for aperture and stuff to make the photo brighter. But when you're there in real life with your own eyes, it's much darker. I mean, it's crazy.
And then you tell me that's only like 3% that's left?
Yeah, the park ranger I was talking to said that forest, now that one drive you drive through... is 31 miles continuous of those redwoods. Mm-hmm. Now, they told me that what exists today is only 3% of what was there 150 years ago.
Golly.
So 97% of the redwood forest has been logged already.
Could you imagine what that used to hold? What kind of critters that thing held hidden out in there?
Sasquatch.
Exactly.
Yeah, very squatchy. Apparently, it's logged so much because of how big they are, but also because redwood is fire resistant, termites don't eat it, and it's very hard.
That's awesome.
Woods. What's cool is like they had one cut in half. And they were showing the tree rings. Of course, everybody knows you can look at the tree rings for age. And they were showing that they're, by the ring count, that some of these trees were there before the Vikings discovered America. So some of the trees in this forest are over 1,000 years old.
Wow.
So That's very impressive. If you're looking for a cool trip you'd like to do, if you, of course, you have to be outdoors. You have to be able to be in shape enough to hike and stuff because it's rough. I mean, it's not easy. But if you're into that kind of thing or you want to take, it's great for kids. Go up there, man, and in Humboldt County in Northern California. Check out those redwoods, man. Pretty cool.
That sounds awesome. The pictures were great.
It was neat. It was a good time. Me and my wife hadn't been on a vacation without the kids in over 10 years. You know, most of the time you do family ski trips and stuff, or we go down to the
Which we've got one of those coming up.
That's right. Yeah, in February, we're going to be going to Colorado. So very interesting. I'll be looking for Sasquatch there as well.
The Sasquatch. Exactly.
But it's good to be back. I'm glad to be back in studio here at Skeleton Studios. So let's kick this off, man. Let's start with the news. Check this out. If soon, Cam, you're going to be able to experience the Betty and Barney Hill abduction yourself.
No thanks, bro. I don't need that in my life. Right? I'm good.
Virtual reality.
Nope. No.
Now, if you're new to the show or you don't know what I'm talking about, let me fill you in. On the night of September 19th, 1961, Barney and Betty Hill were the victims of the first widely publicized alien abduction in United States history. Now, the Hills were an interracial couple, and they were active in the civil rights movement. Well, they were on their way home from a trip to Niagara Falls, New York, when they noticed an unusual light in the sky. Now, shaken by the crazy, erratic behavior of the UFO, they headed in the direction of the closest town, but they never made it. Now, somewhere along the way, they turned off the road where they encountered a fiery orb, and they couldn't quite recall what happened next. So for months afterwards, they had this crazy, unnerving feeling. They weren't sure what happened, so they finally went to a hypnotherapist, and they were put under hypnosis, and the two recovered details of a crazy alien abduction. Now, long before it was called the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, it was originally called the Zeta Reticuli incident. And, of course, it's become the subject of books, TV shows, federal investigations, conspiracy theories, cable TV specials. There's seemingly, you know, countless ways to consume the Hills abduction. But now there's going to be a whole new way. Now, a woman named Laura Wexler wants you to experience it personally firsthand. Now, Wexler, a writer and producer for works, including a book about the last mass lynching in the United States, came across the Hills abduction, she says, while researching another project with a writing partner, a woman named Charlotte Stout, whose writing producing credits include the show House of Cards and the Showtime series Homeland. And the two were immediately drawn to the story, not just for its supernatural appeal, but because of its real-world parallels with racial tensions in the United States today. Well, that's what drew them into it. So then they did some research, and they decided, look, we got a new project here. And they think that the story is a perfect fit for virtual reality. So now they're filming this virtual reality thing, which is going to be called, it's a two-part series. The first one's going to be called Dinner Party, and the other part is called The Incident. And, of course, they give a description of how it starts out. You're at a dinner party at the Hills house, and then they're going to play some of their tapes to friends of the actual abduction. That was, you know, the hypnosis, the recording of their hypnosis. And apparently, you're going to be able to experience what the Hills experienced when they were abducted. So that, you know, I've never been in a virtual reality. I've never used an Oculus Rift or anything like that. But if what I've heard from guys like Duncan Trussell and stuff that mess with it and have their own, it can be quite real. And so it can be quite terrifying, I think, to go in there and have this abduction by the aliens. Now, I do remember, you know, reading a lot about the Betty and Barney Hill. And when they were abducted, they said that there were people on board, like guys in military outfits. A red-haired guy was operating some of the controls. They thought he might have been Irish. They thought there was guys that looked German with German uniforms and also American military uniforms. So, but I don't know how terrifying it's going to be if you feel like you're being abducted by humans. But, I mean, if there are some insectoids or alien grays or whatever, it can be quite terrifying. But if you're into that kind of thing and you're super into UFOs and the subject, this might be the thing for you, is to go and witness what it feels like to be abducted by aliens.
If one of y'all go, let us know, because I'm not going to check it out.
No, I don't think I would either.
I tell you what's funny is, I know this is, while you're telling the story, all I can think of is, I know how us as human beings are. We never can. Nothing's ever good enough. You know, we always talk about the increased use of the phone. I mean, nothing's ever good enough. How long before somebody starts taking some illicit drugs and then goes in there and tries to experience it like that? Could you imagine?
I would say
having a psychedelic trip and being using that while you're being. No, I'm good.
Yeah, it wouldn't take long. I would say if it was released, say, at 12 a.m., I'd say by 1:15 a.m., someone's probably already on some cannabis or something.
Try it out.
Experience. Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
That's just what people do.
Yeah. I ain't hating. I'm just saying.
You ever seen the back of a $20 bill? You ever seen the back of a $20 bill on weed? Right?
Yeah, I ain't hating. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Yeah, that would be, yes, I'm out. I'm not going to go. We'll get a GoFundMe going together. We'll send Kyle, make him go do it. But speaking of insectoid, as you brought up, get a load of this. Now, this came off of Lon. Lon had posted this at Phantoms and Monsters, but he had actually got it, I believe, from Coast to Coast. There's a guy had called in to tell about this, and the headline is what grabbed me over anything. It wasn't so much anything other than this headline, and this is what it says. Black-eyed girl mutates into an insectoid.
What?
Yeah. I'm a sucker for mutating people. But this is something that is really crazy. It says there's a fellow named Anthony from Riverside, California, and he called to talk about this, said back in 1988. And he says, I was just moving out of the house for the first time, and I moved to Crestline with a couple of buddies. Now, this story involves my buddy Nate and myself. Now, he was helping me move into my room, and by then, we'd moved most of my things, and it was at the end of the night, probably around 10 p.m. My room was facing the back of a slope up on a hill, and right above the hill was another house, and there's no fences, so the neighbors and the kids and all this, as I noticed throughout the day, were playing and just going through the yard, you know, like no big deal. When my buddy and I were in the room, we looked out the window and we saw a couple of kids, and it was pretty late, you know, at that time and very dark, and the kids were just playing around having a good time. So I go to get another beer for Nate. And when I come back, he says, the kids went away. And there was just one girl left, and it's kind of weird. Now, we're looking, trying to see if she's okay, because she's just standing there. Kind of just facing, I guess, east. When she started moving slowly. And we noticed that, well, I don't know if it was the moonlight or what, but her skin started becoming more pale. Now, yeah, it was really weird. And she was dressed in normal clothes, and just at that time, she started to put her head up, like looking up,
yeah,
and started looking around. Now, we didn't say anything because we were already a little freaked out, but then when she looked at us, her eyes were all black.
That's not good.
No. And then a couple of seconds later, he says that it was almost reddish black. Really weird. Now, that right there says freaked us out. We slammed the window shut and put the blinds over it. You're like, that's going to protect you. And just as we peeked through the window just to see what was there, it was almost like this. I don't want to say, but it was like a skinwalker, he says, or like something out of the Men in Black movie is what it reminds him of. He said it was all quiet, but it wasn't a girl anymore. It was almost like a man-like body, but the arms and legs were double-jointed, and it was walking crab-like.
What?
Yeah, he said it was very weird. And at this point, said, and this is what it says, it was just screaming like crazy. This thing's walking like a crab, screaming. He says, we ran downstairs and we were trying to figure out whether we should just get in the car, just run out the house and go get in the car. Said, we stayed in the house for about an hour. So my buddy Nate and I were having anxiety through the roof. And then again, at one point, Nate said, all right, that's it. Let's just get out of here. So we ran down across the deck and got into the car. He says, of course, the car's luckily was an automatic. He said, so we just pressed it, you know, get it open, jumped in here, you know, I guess like the electric lock or whatnot on the outside, what he's talking about. And they get in it. He says, well, when we were backing up, you have to go slow. He says, on the very, you know, on this part of this main street from the driveway, and he said, where it's at, you can, you know, drag part of the car when you, I guess, come out of the driveway.
That makes sense.
Steep. Yeah. He says, but we were going a little too fast. So when we hit the bottom, there was the tow hitch. He said, so I guess he's talking about his cars. He's talking about a truck. So he says he went back on it and the front end hit. And he said it flopped around, you know, because you kind of hitting your wedge, dragging it, and you can't get out of there just right. So he's talking about how they were freaking out seeing this. And he's like, I kid you not. He said, and this is what he says. He said, I felt like I was using my body weight to push the car forward, like, go, go. He said, we looked down and they're to the right in front of us. Was this creature still there?
Still there?
Yeah. And he says it was cold. He said it was human-like, with like a man's body, no hair, very pale and insect-like, and its arms were like, and both legs were like disjointed the way it moved around. He said it's the craziest thing. He said it was exactly what a praying mantis looks like in its arms and legs, on this creature, crab walking around there.
Now, what could you mistake that for?
Well, there's nothing. There's nothing on this planet that we're aware of right now that we have cataloged that we could have mistaken it for. But I still, man, every time stuff like this happens, and anytime we start talking about these humanoids and these, and I always bring it up, there's something to this thing of this multiple dimension. There's a lot of people who've talked about it, and you know, they say that, you know, of course we know time is not linear, so there's a lot of these multiple dimensions. I just wonder if there's bleed overs, like we've discussed. If these are in other dimensions, other realms, other whatever that's bleeding over, when people go missing that we never see again, they've bled over into this other dimension with these time slips. Maybe people have, and they never come back. Like when I discussed on the mountain that swallows people.
Yeah, exactly.
And they could see everybody, but they can't see them.
Or maybe that's what happens with the missing hunters and the hikers and all the David Pilatus books. Yeah. Is maybe there's some sort of portals or something up there, and people accidentally fall into it, like you're talking about, and they can't get back.
That's the only thing that would make sense, because there's nothing other than this being a completely fabricated story. There's nothing else that would be able to to answer that question. You don't mistake it. It's not like they put a, like you've seen that Halloween costume, they put like a spider on a dog.
Yeah.
When they make the dog. I mean, that's hilarious when it shows a giant spider running around. It's just a dog. But you're not going to mistake a little girl transforming into that.
It's not going to happen. Very scary. When I was on my trip, I experienced a little bit of,
I bet you did.
Jet lag. You know, it's a real thing. You know, we had to travel to California from Texas. They're 2 hours behind. And then the daylight savings time changed, so it actually put us 3 hours behind. So that first day when I woke up, I was up at like 5 a.m. because my body thinks it's like 8 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were up and at it. Every day I felt like that. Like I can't believe it's only 1 o'clock in the afternoon, or if same thing would be dinner time. I'm like, I cannot believe I'm dog tired at 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was a night where I went to bed later than 11 at p.m., and that's rare for me.
Yeah.
But speaking of that, while I was on the airplane, I read an interesting article about our body and how our internal clocks regulate things. And in a study published in this, I know Cam has a subscription in a journal called The Science Translational Medicine on Wednesday, the scientists showed for the first time how our internal body clocks regulate wound healing by skin cells and optimize healing during the daytime.
Hmm.
It says burns that happened at night took an average of 60% longer to heal than burns that occurred during the day. Now, they said nighttime burns sustained between 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. were 95% healed after an average of 28 days, compared with only 17 days if the burn happened between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m.
That is so strange.
They did, right? It says body clocks, known as our circadian rhythm, regulate almost every cell in our body, driving 24-hour cycles in many processes such as sleeping, hormone secretion, and your metabolism. Now, they said the key to accelerated daytime wound healing, the scientists found, was that skin cells moved more rapidly to repair the wound, and there was also more collagen, the main structural protein in skin, deposited around the wound site during the daytime. Now, a man named John O'Neill, who co-led the research at Britain's Medical Research Council Laboratory of Molecular Biology, he said that this is the first time that the circadian clock within individual skin cells has been shown to determine how effectively they respond to injuries. We consistently see about a twofold difference in wound healing speed between the body clock's day and nighttime. It may be that our bodies have evolved to heal fastest during the day when injuries are more likely to occur, because most people are sleeping at night. Now, according to these recent studies, treatments of wounds cost health services worldwide billions of dollars a year, and he thinks by able to manipulate when people go in for surgeries, they can actually time to make your body heal quicker. So it's a weird thing, but if you get an injury, a cut, or a burn during the daytime, your wound is much more likely to heal quicker than if it happens at nighttime, and it's simply based on your circadian rhythm. That's insane. So now they're going to be changing what time during the day a surgery is carried out. They're also going to time what time during the day medicines are given out, because they know that during daytime hours, it heal quicker.
Well, I wonder, you bring all that stuff up. For thousands of years, we Your body is programmed for that because of...
We didn't have artificial light.
We didn't. Not until the 1800s, right. 1880s, 1882, something along those lines, whenever we had it. So we've had it a little over 100 years.
We've talked about it many times. When you go camping or we go on our outdoor trips or hunting, how it only takes you about 2 or 3 days and you fall in that rhythm where you wake up when the sun comes up and when the sun goes down, you're ready for bed.
Yeah. And it's weird. You can throw your phone, your watch... It used to be funny because when we would go all the time running and blowing and going like that, you never took an alarm clock. You were up right before daylight.
You don't have to, yeah.
It's funny how your body, and it doesn't take long. Like you would think, oh, it would take me weeks to get you. Nah, about 2 days, 3 days, and you're right back into that. I mean, that's because that's the way it's supposed to be. So yep. Now you're showing if you get injured, because most of the time you were up during the day. Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you notice when the sun starts going down, you're out in the woods like that, your body starts producing melatonin. I don't care how long you want to stay up. After it's been dark a couple hours, you're dog tired. Even if you haven't been hiking.
Yeah.
They have software now where your phone or your computer or your lights in your house, you can set it to where it'll slowly start getting dimmer in the evenings. It'll naturally make you get tired.
Just stay away from it.
Yeah, it's terrible because nowadays, I mean, I know Cam for himself, he'll spend all night looking at YouTube, just video to video to video.
I will go hard if I'm not careful.
I do the same thing. And when you're done and you turn it off and you do lay in bed, don't you lay in bed for like another hour? You're like, dude, I'm not tired. I think it's because you've been looking at those screens.
It is bright. It's too bright. Yeah, for sure. Like you got to draw the line and go, look, you can't keep going.
Yeah.
You got to stop going. You got to go watch nature's TV, the campfire. Something about just looking at the campfire and the warmth, you'll go right to sleep. Unless you hear a story like this. Kyle, I got something for you. Cue the predator sound, folks. A Pennsylvania family claims predator-like humanoid sighting.
Want some candy?
I love it. Cryptozoology news. This report was originally sent there, and they said it's being published in its entirety. Now, it says the eyewitness provided a name and contact information, but this is how the report goes. It says, hi, I finally gained the courage to tell people about an encounter my husband and I had some years ago. We recently bought our home in a new area in western Pennsylvania. Then it's close to where I was raised. And I found the home listed for sale on the internet in the fall of 2000. So soon after, we bought the home and became familiar with our surroundings. The next year, before, it says buck season, but you know, because that's what they, you know, deer season up there. It says we were out with our spotlight to go and view the deer in the area. And we drove down our long dirt road and turned onto another dirt road. Now, these roads are the kind that only locals would use because they're so bumpy and treacherous and didn't really take you anywhere but, you know, to the local farms. Says there's no winter maintenance for snow removal either. So just as we turned off of our road and onto the next, my husband was shining the spotlight on the left side of the road from the driver's seat of our car. Now, he continued to drive slowly, flashing the light around, when he shone the light in what looked like a driveway. It was actually one of a series of roads meant for gas trucks to tap from various gas wells in the area. Now, they are quite common and abundant, and as he shined the light in this small dirt road that resembled a driveway, he kept his light fixed. And at first, I had deer ingrained in my mind and was expecting to see the shape of a deer. And as I stared at this shape, I realized that I did not know what I was looking at. I knew it wasn't a deer. It wasn't any animal at all. And as my brain tried to comprehend what I was looking at, it became more clear the longer I stared. What I saw had the shape of a man, but it was not a man. It was not see-through as a ghost. The only way I can describe it was like standing water. But it didn't cast a shadow. It didn't have any glare to it as the light was on it. It did not reflect the light, and it was not a gas, as gas does not have a significant shape. Gas will ebb and flow with the breeze, or at least have an inconsistent shape. Rather, what I saw had a defined shape. That was the only way I can see it, because it had the shape of a human, and I could make out that part because of the defined edges and curves. Now, only because of its outline was I able to make out what I was looking at, and when I realized that I was looking at a human shape, I noticed the posture was similar to a person skulking or sneaking. It was hunched over a little, and one of its arms were frozen in place in front of it, as though it knew we saw it, and it froze its position to try to be undetectable. Well, a few seconds had passed as it stood there like a mannequin in mid-step, frozen in space. And in front of it, I could see a small knoll about a foot and a half tall that had a small graded slope to it. Now, after what seemed like a long time, but only moments, I remember feeling very afraid. What I was looking at knew that I was looking at it, and it could easily pounce at us. It was only maybe 10 foot in front of us on the driver's side of the road. It was standing in some low grass beside the driveway Gaswell Road. It was close enough to hurt us. I didn't know what this thing was, and I didn't want to find out what it was capable of doing. Our sons were at home right down the road from where we were. But nobody really knew where we were, that if we'd needed help, there was no one around for a couple miles. There's no cell service on our road. We were out there alone with this thing. Well, after we stared at this thing for maybe 10 seconds, it then began to slowly crouch into a seated-like position, but having its feet underneath it like it was ready to lunge at us. And again, I could not see its body parts, only the outside shape of it. After it remained in the squatted position for a few more seconds, it then appeared to slowly lay down onto the little knoll, and then it disappeared. I could no longer see it. It had just seemingly vanished. Now, I could not believe what I had just seen, and I was stunned to the core. I then began to doubt that what I saw, and then I said to myself, I must be seeing things. This is just crazy. I resolved to not even say a word to my husband. I thought he'd poke fun at me and not even believe me anyway. Then my husband turned and looked at me and said, "Did you just see that too?" Well, after hearing him admit that he had seen exactly what I just saw, I turned to him with my mouth still hung open and told him, "Yes, I just saw that too." Then I immediately told him to drive and get me the hell out of there. And that's so strange, and what's so strange is that my husband thought the exact same thing that I thought, that he was seeing things too. And like me, he wasn't going to say anything. He thought, I guess, you know, but of this whole deal, that it was no big deal. You know, I'm not going to say anything. But it was exactly what he finally, like a husband's like, wait a minute. I've got to say something. You know, he turned to something. He said what he saw was the shape of a man. He saw it hunched over as if we had caught it red handed. And he said that it looked like it was cloaked like the Predator, but it didn't have a jagged camouflage look. He said the thing that we saw had a smooth look. Of course, again, like standing water without the reflective aspect, and its outside shape was smooth but definitive, you know, so you could see the outline, but it's perfectly smooth. Says, I don't know what we saw, but I do know it was real, and I've been really guarded about this experience and have only told a few people because I know how skeptics are, because I'm one of them, yet I cannot refute what we saw. It was real, but nevertheless, whatever it was or is that we saw, there's no doubt in my mind or my husband's. Says, after another reason and why I'm finally sharing this is because I've been watching various TV shows about cryptic phenomena like Bigfoot, and it's October and creepy shows are starting to air again at this time, and watching these shows reminded me of this experience years ago, and that even after all these years, I've never done any research to see if anyone else has had a similar encounter. He goes on to say that for a long time, I just as soon wanted to forget about that night, but now I thought I'd do a Google search of predator-like sightings and was astonished to see a couple of people seeing what I saw. Says, then I came upon this website and decided to tell our story. Goes into talking about a lot of, you know, these things and how she feels about it and these cloaking abilities and stuff that nobody, we really don't have any answers because we don't really know. And it's funny, I love the way she's approaching this whole thing is my husband and I, you know, we both know exactly what we saw. They didn't tell but a couple of people for 17 years.
Yeah.
There's not a ton of sightings. I mean, it's true. We've discussed probably every one of them that there's ever been, Kyle and I have probably covered, that you can find of these predator-like sightings. The reason there's probably not a lot of sightings is it could be right there, and you could walk right by it, and if it wasn't truly well-defined, if it's, like they're talking about, it vanished, more than likely it laid down and blended in, and you just couldn't see it.
Yeah. I'm wondering if this truly is like an extraterrestrial being that's cloaked itself and is just monitoring humans, watching what we're doing in our day-to-day lives, things like that. Or, like we've talked about earlier, is it something from another universe, another parallel universe? Or, put your conspiracy hat on, is this some type of camouflage that the government has developed and this is what they did is they caught somebody testing it? I mean, what better way to test it? Just like we talk about with, you know, highly classified aircraft. If the military government or some agency within the government developed some super technical cloaking camouflage, wouldn't the best way to test it is to go out and try to see if people can see you? And the guy that was wearing it was like, oh, don't, they do see me. And that's when he tried to, slither off.
But I wouldn't want to be testing it in the cold and the snow out in the middle of nowhere with the hopes of somebody spotlighting that didn't have a gun to take a pop
that's
shot
true.
At it. You know,
that's
something
true.
Like, I wonder this, back to that multidimensional thing. What we're seeing, is it just a shimmer of what it is? Like, they don't look that way normally. It's just because they're not fully through the envelope. They're caught in that in-between world, and so they look like that funky outline that you're seeing is them trying to push through that veil or tear through that film, and that film is what makes them look like that, not necessarily them.
Yeah, that's a good theory.
I don't know, but I love the idea of these predator sightings altogether. Folks, like Kyle said, he's been to the Winchester house. And when we get back from this break, I'm going to talk about some strange homes around. And then we're probably going to get into the Winchester house, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Let's, you know what? I've got so much stuff here. Some of this stuff I can't get to. I got too much stuff to chit chat about, go crazy with on some of this. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to skip. I'm going to save some of this for the Elite Show, and we're just going to dive right into it because I want to tell the story because this is a really cool story. And then I'm going to pick your brain, Mr. Filson, when we get done with this because I want to get into the Winchester Mystery House.
Okay, yeah.
Now, I'm going to lay this out for y'all that don't know about this whole thing. I've been a fan of this, not so much the house as I was of William, because of the fella, you know, Winchester Firearms. That was one of the things. But what we're going to get into is this. Basically, the story of the Winchester house started back in September of 1839, let's say, all the way back, with this woman, this baby girl that was born to a Leonard and Sarah Pardee there in Connecticut, New Haven, actually. And this baby's name was Sarah. And she actually became what they called the belle of the city at this time. She was very well received at all the social events. Beautiful, beautiful girl. Very musically skilled, lots of talent. Let's say foreign languages came to her very, very easily, which that's a talent in and of itself.
She was wealthy. She was born to a wealthy family. These were well-to-do people.
And she was very charming. And like they said, she was very diminutive, if you will. She's very tiny, you know, very cute little thing. When I say tiny, like I'm talking like very petite, like she was under 5 foot, 4 foot, 10, I believe is actually what she was. So she was a very small woman and pretty. A very pretty, like they talk about it in all the writings, how beautiful that she was. Well, at the time of her growing up, there was a young fella there from another well-to-do family. And this young fella's name was William Wirt Winchester. His father was Oliver Winchester. Now, Oliver was a businessman there, but he also was a shirt manufacturer, textiles, things along those lines. So in 1857, he took over this whole thing, and he made what was known then as the Volcanic Repeater. Okay, now that is a rifle. That's a lever-action rifle. Mm. Kind of like the old 30-30s and stuff that you see. Lucas McCain, like the rifleman. Those are Winchesters. That's what those are. So, you get into this. Now, you got to imagine it. It doesn't sound like much to us now, a lever-action rifle. But at the time, those were muzzle-loading rifles was what was still going on. For those of you that aren't aware of a muzzle-loader, basically the barrel is just like that. It's a barrel. It's a tube of a rifle. You pour your gunpowder into it, and then you put a patch down into it. Most of it was waxed cloth. You push down into it to pack the gunpowder tight. And on top of that waxed cloth, you put a lead ball of some sort, push down tight into the barrel. And you compact them all because, like we all know, loosely packed gunpowder only burns. It doesn't really explode. So you have to keep it pretty tight. Well, it takes a little work to do this with any sort of speed, especially in combat. Well, when you have a lever action rifle, and then you manufacture the rounds, the brass and the shell and the bullet and all that that goes into these, well, then you have multiple rounds that you can put down range. So it works a lot easier than an old muzzle loader. But William still wanted to advance what he was working on by this whole thing. So in 1860, he developed the Henry rifle, which is known as the repeater, which is really good because it is there's a tube that actually lays under the barrel of a repeating rifle, just like in the 30-30s and the old Henrys. And you load it. I believe the Henry was actually loaded through the stock of the gun. You took the butt cap off of the stock.
Yeah, if you ever see like the old Clint Eastwood movies where he'll pull the
Unforgiven. And that's it.
That's exactly right. That's where he's loading in that magazine, the cartridges.
Yeah.
Which was basically the same process Cam's talking about, but it was made into a carrying cartridge.
Yep, that's all it was.
The same thing. And when Winchester developed this, that's what made him so popular, the most popular gun in the world at that time.
They said that's the gun that won the West, was that right there. But yeah, so you're talking about, if you go and watch the movie Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman, the Henry rifle is the one that Morgan Freeman carries. That's what gun that is. So Mr. Winchester is the fella that invented all this thing because, like we said, it was easy to reload. You could fire it very rapidly. Average shot, they said, was every 3 seconds. You could get one shot every 3 seconds. So it also became a big favorite for the Northern troops in the Civil War. So, of course, money starts piling in there. And when I say piling, we're talking back in the day, a extremely large fortune, and then government contracts. Not only from private sales they were making money, but then the government steps in and wants to buy them. So what ends up happening? Well, Oliver and his son completely reorganize everything, come out with the name of the company is the Winchester Repeating Arms Company. So this all started. So you got to imagine this. This is in 1862 at the height of the Civil War. It's going big. Everything's going great. And William and Sarah become married, and they get married in a ceremony there, very elaborate wedding. They're in New Haven. And then 4 years later, July 15th of 1866, Miss Sarah gives birth to a daughter named Annie. And then a short time later, it was a little disaster because Annie contracted an illness known as marasmus, which is a children's disease. Which is a Wastings disease is what it is. So the baby dies on July 24th. So it's born on the 15th, dies on the 24th. Well, this, like it would do any mother, pretty much destroys Sarah. So she kind of becomes withdrawn, depressed, pulls into herself, has nothing to do with anybody or anything. And people believe that she was going mad. And it was nearly a decade went by before she actually returned to normal, what they said was her normal, and that they would even have another child. So for almost 10 years, she fought with this depression. So the story goes that, you know, not long after she had returned to her, you know, her family home and all this stuff and this, that there was another tragedy come down. William, of course, you know, the fellow responsible for the Winchester Empire, gets pulmonary tuberculosis and dies in March of 1881. So Sarah, now you got to imagine this, folks, 1881, Sarah herself inherits $20 million.
Yeah, and today that's like billion.
Billion, yeah. $20 million in 1881, all right? Yeah. She also receives 48.9% of the Winchester Repeating Arms Company and an income of, you ready for this? $1,000 a day was what she made off of that in 1881. Now, none of this was taxable until 1913. All right. So this is all pre-IRS. This is all where she
was making more money than you could spend.
Oh, yeah. Especially at that time. You cannot even imagine. So, of course, it didn't help her. You've got to imagine. Not only now has she lost the single love of her life, but she has lost a child. So you can only, I mean, money can't replace that. Doesn't matter how much money you make. You all hear the stories of Steve Jobs. What did he say is one of his regrets? He didn't spend enough time with his kids. I mean, you know, it's one of those, doesn't matter how much money you have. So Sarah's taking it really, really hard. So a good friend of hers goes, you know what? And you have to think about the times, goes, hey, look, let's go to a spiritualist. Let's go get a medium. Let's, you know, go talk to him. Let's go see if she can contact your husband. So they're like, okay, she's down with it. So the medium says, hey, look, your husband's here. And she gives a description of William. And he says, you know, for me to tell you that there's a curse on your family. That's what this medium says. There's a curse on your family, and that's what took his life, and that's what killed your baby, and that soon it's going to come for you. That's what this medium says. Well, you can only imagine how well that went over at this whole thing. And the medium pretty much alludes to the fact that it is there because of the construction of the Williams or the Winchester repeating rifle. That's why there's a curse, because of all the thousands and thousands of people that were killed because of his invention. Well, so what's Sarah do? That she's pretty much told then that she's going to sell all of her property there in New Haven, and she's going, this is what the medium said, and you need to move towards the setting sun. So she says that she was guided by her husband, and she found the new home going to head west. And the medium says, your husband says that when you see it, you'll recognize it, but that you must start a new life, is what she tells her that she does. And she even goes so far to say that you must build a home for yourself and for the spirits who have fallen to this terrible weapon also. And one thing that sticks out is she says you can never stop building the house.
Yeah.
Which is wild. And it says that if you continue building, you will live. But if you stop building, you will die. So what does end up Sarah doing? She sells her home. And of course, with all this money, endless fortune of money, she moves to California. And that she actually believed that she was being guided by her husband, and that this is where she needed to go, and that she moved and moved and moved, just following the flow, until she reached Santa Clara Valley in 1884. And at that point, she was, of course, drawn to this certain area, and she found a home under construction. And at the time, it belonged to a Dr. Caldwell. Now, this was a six-room home. So she goes and starts talking to Dr. Caldwell, and she convinces him to sell her the house and the 162 acres that came with the house. Well, here's what's wild. He sells her all this stuff. She takes the building plans that he had, crumbles them up, throws them in the fireplace, burns them up. She's done. She goes and she gets local craftsmen, local workers, everybody around this whole place, and she employs them to start working on this house. Now, I'm going to tell you all this, and this is going to really get you going. Not for just a little bit. For the next 36 years, they built and rebuilt and altered and changed and demolished and reconstructed one section of the house after another. She kept 22 carpenters working year-round, 24 hours a day. There are people reporting that the sounds of saws and hammers could be heard for year after year after year, around the clock at this house. The house grew to include this, folks, 26 rooms. All right. Railroad cars were switched into, onto a nearby line just to bring building material and import furnishings for this house.
Yeah.
It was also growing and expanding. And here's the greatest thing. When she was asked, Sarah had no plan for it. It was just add on to this room. All right, you got this one finished out. Go right beside it, add on to the next one. That she met each morning with her foreman, and that they would go over these plans that she had just hand sketched up. She just sat around there, I guess nothing else to do when you're making $1,000 a day. She'd hand sketched up. They even reported how chaotic they were. They were very just, almost not childlike, but just mad sketches. But as it grew, she got better and better and better, and was actually had a real panache for being able to draw up building plans, because it's something you did for 36 years. You're going to get good at it. Now, they did say that some of it wouldn't work out, of course, right away. Something would fall apart, something wouldn't build right, something wouldn't be that. So her basically a solution for this was, okay, we'll just build another room around that one. Just leave that one inside one and just build walls around that one and leave it in there. Well, of course, as days and weeks and months and all this passed, room after room after room is added, turns into entire wings, doors were joined to windows, levels. I mean, everything was going. I mean, you got to imagine. Inside the house, there's 3 elevators were installed and 47 fireplaces. 47 fireplaces. They said there are countless staircases that lead to nowhere, blind chimneys that stop just short of the ceiling, just goes up and stops, closets that you open up to just walls, blank walls, trap doors, double back hallways, skylights located one above another one, doors that open to the lawn. You open it up, it's just a drop off down into the lawn. All kinds of wild stuff. Stair posts were installed upside down, and bathrooms had glass doors on them. It says, and here's what's really odd with Sarah. Sarah become infatuated with the number 13. Nearly all the windows in this house contain 13 panes of glass. The walls have 13 panels. The cupolas on the greenhouse, number 13. The wooden floors have 13 sections. Some of the rooms have 13 windows. And every staircase in that home except one have 13 steps. Now, the exception is unique, of course, in its own right. It's a winding staircase with 42 steps, which would normally be enough to take, of course, up three stories. This one only rises 9 feet because each one of those steps is only 2 inches tall.
Yep. I was going to say, they said that she, I don't know if it was arthritis, but she had something where she couldn't, her knees were real weak and she couldn't step real good.
Mm-hmm.
So she had the carpenters come in, and each step, if you would imagine, is only 2 inches high, but it's really long.
Mm-hmm. It's a deep landing.
Deep.
Yeah.
So, like, you feel like you went, like, around, say, it's like a spiral staircase. Imagine that. Except it's more like long, rectangular style.
As it works up.
As it works up.
You can shuffle your feet, barely get one up. Shuffle your feet, barely get one up.
And they're like that. And they're, I mean, narrow. Like, so
she was tiny.
Tiny. There's rooms that are only, like, 5'5". Like, hallways. So, you, like, if you're claustrophobic, don't go to the Winchester house. It's madness. It doesn't make any sense. It looks like a crazy person was building. Because, like, you're right, well, there's some rooms
that... A crazy person was building it.
The rooms don't make any sense. Sometimes you'll just go up two steps, and you'll be in another room. The other one, halfway through the room, will go down. And then in some of the rooms, you'll see the exterior of what used to be the house. They didn't remove that.
No, they built around
Yeah, you could tell.
Yeah.
I guess the carpenters were just like, hey, look, we got a steady job. Let's just keep building.
Do what you're told. Imagine, you know, like we used to always laugh, getting on with the municipality was the best job to have. Imagine what it was like to try to get on. You're talking about keeping people working for 36 years. Those are people that could have started to work, raised their son, brought them to work as carpenters, and worked there before the father retired and the son kept working.
And she was known as being very generous. Like, everybody that worked for her, she would build them their own houses nearby. She built them their own quarters for she had, you know, waiters and bellhops and stuff that lived in the house. Took care of her. She gave them everything. I mean, like, if you worked for her, you were taken care of because she had so much money. She was very generous. And there's some of the rooms, like, there was like three conservatories where, because she loved plants, so there'd be all kinds of like skylights like you're talking about. And what was cool is the room would be built where it tilted just slightly to a corner, and then in that corner would be a drain, and the floors were lined in zinc and then wood floors put over the top of that, so when you're watering your plants, it doesn't matter if the wood rotted, where all the water, the excess water, would just drain down to that zinc floor and then out, because the floor is slightly tilted, to a drain hole, and that hole would go outside. I mean, so she thought of everything and spared no expense.
Yeah. Well, the house continues to grow. And then, of course, in 1906, it was 7 stories tall. Now, she continued the expansion, the house, the whole thing, living the whole deal. Now, she lived there by herself. There was no one other than her servants and the workmen, and that was it. So it's not like she was married and had... No. Now, they go on to say that she would have sleepless nights, and that, you know, that she would have these night terrors, if you will, of having all this stuff going, and that when she couldn't sleep, that she would get up in the early hours of the morning and play a grand piano, and that people could hear it playing, and they said that they was always known it because there were two keys that were out of tune, but they said you could always hear it because people on the street would even stop and listen to her play this piano coming out of there. But of course, in 1906, what happens in San Francisco? The earthquake. So the earthquake hits, and there was a lot of the Winchester house left in ruins. The top 3 floors collapsed into the garden, and it was never rebuilt. The fireplace that was located what's called the Daisy Room, which is where she was actually sleeping on the night of the earthquake, collapsed. The room, it actually trapped Sarah in that room a little bit, but she became convinced that the earthquake had been a sign from the spirits that this medium had told her about, that were furious because she had nearly completed the house. So it goes on to say that in order to ensure that it would never be finished, she decided to board up the front 30 rooms of the house so that construction would not be complete. And also so that the spirits who she believed had, you know, fell into this whole thing would be trapped in that part of the house forever. So for the next several months after this, the workmen repaired the damage done by the earthquake. And that this, you know, they were surprised at how well something this size had actually survived all that, but it had gone through. Now, there were a few rooms that had been, you know, pretty bad, and they had even lost, like we said, the highest floor. Some of the cupolas had fallen over, things like that. But then the expansion again began again, and the bedrooms increased from 15 to 20, then to 25, when we talked about more chimneys for no purpose whatsoever to have going on. Now, here's what's odd, and I was going to ask you this, Kyle, but it is said, and I've read it on several spots, that they were only two mirrors installed in the entire house.
Yeah, I didn't see any of them.
Well, they say it's because Sarah believed that the ghosts were afraid of their own reflection. So she didn't put them in the home at all, the whole deal. But on September 4th, folks, 1922, there was another seance there in the house, in the seance room that she had built, and that she had gone to her bedroom that evening. And at some point in the early morning hours, at the age of 83, Sarah passed away. Now, she left everything to her niece, Frances. And Frances had been handling most of Sarah's bill paying and all that stuff for some time. You got to imagine 83. She probably bailed out on that, you know, back probably around the earthquake time. She's probably like, that's it. Here's what's wild, though. What little people didn't know was that she had been almost broke. She was running through that money like crazy over all these years. And when I say that broke, as far as bank account broke, there wasn't a lot of money in her bank account. They believed that she had taken a lot of it, turned it into jewelry, turned it into gold, all this stuff, and had hidden it in a safe in the house. They believed that it was there, that somewhere hidden in the house. So her relatives show up, and they forced open a number of safes in this house. You know what they find in there? Socks. Newspaper clippings about her husband's death, her daughter's death, a lock of baby hair, some old wool underwear. Nothing was found like that. And like we talked about, the furnishings, all the personal belongings, all the surplus construction material, all the stuff that was there was removed from the house, and the structure itself was sold to a group of investors who planned to use it as a tourist attraction. And then the first place to see it when it was open to the public was Robert Ripley. And he featured it in Believe It or Not. Now, it was advertised initially to be 148 rooms, but it was so confusing to the floor plan that every time a room count was taken, everybody came up with a different number. Like, they couldn't keep up with exactly how many it was. Now, here's another thing that was cool. It said it took workmen more than 6 weeks just to get all the furniture out of it because moving men became so lost. Because it was like a maze down through there trying to get the stuff in and out of there. And like you're talking about, it's small, it's narrow. You're like, how do we get? It's like they moved furniture in and then built rooms around it so you could never get the furniture out. And they also said this. And this is what it says. It was a house that where downstairs leads neither to the cellar nor upstairs to the roof. The rooms of the house were counted over and over again and again, and 5 years later it was estimated that 160 rooms existed, although no one is really sure if that number was even correct. Now, of course, today it's a historical landmark in California. It's registered with the National Park Service. This is what it's called, a large, odd dwelling with an unknown number of rooms, is what it says on it. We go through now. Like I said, I've not been there. I've always thought it was a funny story. It was a very strange story of the stuff that's happened in there. Some people have reported seeing ghosts that have been working there and doing the tours and stuff like you've taken there. Some people have reportedly hearing these ghosts. I know there's a lot of psychics have visited this house over and over. Some of them say that they're convinced that there's still spirits, kind of like 13 ghosts. You know, there's like this house is full of spirits that maybe, you know, initially that's what she was trying to do was to capture spirits in this house. I know some people say that they've even thought that they've seen the ghost of Sarah still in this whole house. And that they hear footsteps and voices and cold spots, and that they can hear doorknobs rattling and churning and turning and all this. So all of the strange madness that a woman, basically brokenhearted, and sad with unlimited funds used to try to keep herself safe and to hang on to some sort or some sense of mental stability. I'm going to turn to you to have you tell me about what you experienced there and what you felt whenever you were running around in there.
All right. Well, let's get to that, but let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, we'll talk about it.
All right.
You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Yeah, let's talk about my trip.
Because you started sending me pictures, and Winchester, I'm like, that house is awesome.
I'm glad.
The outside that house is so badass.
It's one of the things where, and if you're married, you probably run into this. It's one of the things my wife talked me into going. Well, and I'm so glad she did. Because
I'm glad you said that, because I had to cut you off. But I knew you had never brought it up. And I never thought about it, because it's one of those things. I've read about this house years ago.
Yeah, I saw it on,
as we were kids with guns. You just, like, you start, oh, I want to find out about Winchester. It's like Mr. Browning. You start finding out about the Browning repeater. You start people that enjoy firearms and the history of all that, you get caught up in stuff like this. But I never once even thought about you going. And then when you went, I'm like, well, he never said anything about going before he left.
Yeah, it's one of the, I saw originally like on Unsolved Mysteries or something like that when I was a kid, and I just kind of forgotten about it. I didn't know what it, I just knew that, oh yeah, it's a supposedly haunted house or whatever. My wife apparently has always wanted to see it. She's like, hey, it's gonna be right where we're going, can we stop by and do it? I'm like, sure, yeah. So we get there, and at first when you pull up, because it's a little deceiving, I was like, oh man, it's one of those letdowns. You're just like, I knew it. The website built it up. It's not near as big as I thought it was. But I was wrong. It was the perspective from the drive up, the parking lot that I had parked in. From that vantage point, you couldn't see much. This thing is huge. When I say huge, I'm talking huge. This thing is ginormous. It's right. It's 160 rooms, okay? And they don't make any sense. But and lush gardens and just all kinds of carriage houses, just everything that you could possibly think of. And the tour we went on was a really good tour. First of all, the tour is 3 hours long.
Wow.
I thought you were going to get to see like maybe a few rooms. No, we got to see 150 of what is believed 160 rooms.
Do you think if you had never been in that house and they brought you in by yourself, and could you easily have gotten lost in there?
Dude, I mentioned it several times while the tour, because like you're talking about, it's seven stories.
Yeah.
It goes up to seven stories. I'm like, dude, I am so lost right now. And the tour guide, it was pretty cool because the tour group is small. It's like you and like maybe 12 other people. So very small.
You're the only people that are crazy enough to come all the way to California to go through this house.
And the tour guide actually said that once a year, them and all the other employees, they play a huge game of hide and go seek.
Oh, how crazy would that be?
He says, it's amazing. And I said, how you do? And he said, you know who wins every time? The people that do the cleaning. He's like, the people that clean the property.
Oh, they know every place.
They know every nook and cranny. And there's been several years where the cleaning crew, we can't find them. And they won't tell us where they went because they don't want to lose. I guess there's some kind of bet.
There's probably a hidden areas in that house that even the people giving the tour have no idea it's there.
Yeah, dude, it is creepy. And like I said, not every room is super small or super skinny, but just some of them, some of the walkways. Some of them are normal size. Some of them are grand. And that's what they talked about. It's like you walk in the grand, like when you walk in the front door, immediate to your left is a little sitting area and stuff. And then there's this big grand hall. The problem is she was a recluse. She never had any guests over. So why she built all these elaborate halls and dancing quarters and things like that, no one ever came there. Apparently, she owned three other homes not that far away from there. And if you were just going to entertain people, she would always do it at those houses. But her main house, no one ever visited there. You weren't allowed to come.
It's the home for the spirits. That's why she built it.
The home for the spirits is home for the workers. It seemed like when I first got there, I was under the assumption that her and Mr. Winchester lived there. That's not true. I didn't learn until afterwards. And you brought it up. That was all. She moved there and built that after he had already passed on. And it's very interesting. She has there's one room there. It's called the seance room. And apparently she would go up there and have these seances nightly. There was a cool bell tower. They would always ring, I think, at 2 a.m. and again at straight up midnight. Weird things like that. Every night that would happen. There's all kinds of beautiful, intricate stained glass windows. And I'm talking these things top notch. They said they were like made in Italy or France, and she had it shipped over. Of course, like you were talking about back in those days, everything was shipped by rail. But some of these beautiful stained glass windows would just be in the middle of the house, not going to the exterior. Like, it just wouldn't make sense. It would just be, you'd be walking in a hallway and all of a sudden there's a window there. But the window doesn't, it just goes into like a closet, or the window would go into another hallway. And it just, it doesn't make sense. The doors, some of them are super tall, some of them are super small, some of them go to nothing. They said because she had so much money, she would always buy in excess. So check this out. There's 160 believed rooms in the house. Mm-hmm. There's over 2,000 doorways in that house.
So they'd just be a wall with a door that opened up to a brick, and that would be
some it. Of them would. Some of them would go into rooms. And so she would buy 4,000 doors.
And then you got to use them.
And so same thing with doorknobs. If she needed 2,000 doorknobs, she'd buy 4,000. So when she'd passed on, there was all kinds of excess stuff that was just never used. She was constantly buying stuff for the construction. So the guys never stopped, like you're talking about. They were building, sawing, hammering, working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 36 years. And some of the rooms, they didn't just add on. Sometimes they would be finished and she'd like redo it. And so they would take it and then redo it. And then other times he would just add a room on for no reason.
Let me ask you this, though. It's not like it was shoddy craftsmanship either.
No.
We're talking about beautiful carpentry.
Beautiful.
When we're talking about also being done by a lot of hand tooling, didn't have a lot of fancy. You're talking about a lot of block plane work. You're talking Absolutely. About a lot of work.
Like when you go to a house today and you guys, the guys that do trim work, and you see chair rails and crown molding and stuff. Yeah, this is all hand done.
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff. I mean, the staircases. Just the
yeah, this isn't a machine that milled out the crown and all that stuff. These are hand block planes where the blades themselves are cut in that shape, and you start out shaving them down, and you shave them into the shape that you need mm-hmm. to use. I mean, every piece is handmade.
And it was a long tour. It was very, very good. And you can ask my wife off air. There were several times we were walking, and you would all of a sudden find a cold spot. Like, I mean, like really cold.
Is that the first time it's ever happened to you in a home? It's never happened to me in a
first
home.
First time I've ever experienced it. Like, the first time I noticed it, I didn't say nothing. And then the second time she came and got me, she's like, does it feel like oddly cold right here? And I would stand, and it would. And then you could walk to the other side of the room and it wouldn't feel that way. But I mean, cold, cold, like you're standing in a walk-in cooler almost. But there's no central heat and air in this.
So you would walk from one end of the room to the other, and one end would be fine. And you could walk and be in the cold. Then you would come back and be warm. See, and that cold spot never moved. It's just sitting there.
Yeah.
Oh, you experienced something pretty wild.
Also, a couple of times, me and her both separately didn't discuss it till afterwards, I got the scent of a woman's perfume. Just like all of a sudden really strong. No woman walked by me. It wasn't like an old grandma walked by and now I'm catching. We would be sitting there. There'd be nobody there. And all of a sudden you'd just get it. And I'd be like, that's really weird.
So you really had a good, yeah, it was, good time.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. But I did have some crazy experiences. And then they take you to this one room, and they were showing this one set of windows on the front. And they were showing over the last like 15 years, people who had visited just like we did had taken pictures with their cell phones or their cameras, and then later found something, and then they emailed the Winchester house.
Oh, that's cool.
These pictures. And in this one window, there's been like 18 accounts. Just in the last like 6 years, there's something odd standing mm-hmm. in that window.
I was going to bring that up.
Oh, okay.
But I just didn't. I was like, no, because that goes down a whole nother path, because it's a lot of people have seen stuff up there. And that's where you're talking about in that one spot, a lot of photographs.
And what's crazy is because there's more than one tour. We did the big shebang, and I'm talking, it was like $37 for a 3-hour tour. You get to see everything. But on one of the tours before we did that, we walked right through that area, and that's where I experienced one of those cold spots. It wasn't until the second tour that they showed us those pictures all in that window. And so where all these images were shown is exactly where me and her felt that cold presence.
That's wild.
So it is wild. And then, of course, you know, me being the conspiracy guy, I'm looking at these photos and I'm trying to think, you know, could that be a reflection off something? You know,
mm-hmm.
But I don't know, man. Some of the images, like they have them zoomed in, of course, there at the little visiting center. Man, it looks weird. I guess you could stage it if you wanted to, just to try to, you know, get more people interested. But, if you're already there, then you're already interested.
So you would suggest, say people that live in California that have never been there, you would suggest going?
I would strongly suggest going. It's in San Jose, which is just south of San Francisco. Like, I'm talking an hour's drive.
I'm going to have to go check it out now. I want to go see it.
It was really good, really worth the money. I was so glad I went there. And apparently there's a new movie that's coming out with Helen Mirren called Winchester, the House That Ghost Built. It's already been filmed. It's going to come out in 2018. It's a horror movie. You can already go online and watch the trailer for it right now. I'll put links in the show notes.
Oh, that'll be awesome.
So now, of course, my wife, she's a big horror fan. She's like super excited. She's like, oh, I'm definitely seeing that.
the whole deal. Folks, before we go any further, thank y'all so much for killing the game with the reviews.
Right?
I've seen it with the whole thing. I mean, people from Asia has been writing reviews. I mean, look.
Keep
them coming, man. I cannot tell you what it means to us to read those Christmas time and the camo Crocs and the whole thing. Yeah, it's for reals. That's all reals. I love it. And it helps us more than anything. It really does. It helps us a ton to keep staying relevant, to keep in that. I don't understand whatever that stuff is, the way it works. And I don't know how that thing works. But I know as long as the reviews are coming in, we stay right up there on that whole top. So please, folks, however you got to do it, please borrow a friend's if you have to. Just, you don't even got to download it. Just go on there. However you want to do it, just write us a review, please.
Please. And also, if you want to help out the show, you can do a survey for us. This helps us out. You have to go to podcastlistener.com/expanded. That's podcastlistener.com/expanded. Let's talk about our sponsor real quick. For a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor and a tube of the Dr. Kava Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, the razors are just a few bucks a month, but you have to use our code, folks, to get this deal. You have to go to dollarshaveclub.com/expanded. That's dollarshaveclub.com/expanded. Also, if you like Expanded Perspectives and you want more, there's Expanded Perspectives Elite. That's right. If you like Expanded Perspectives, you're only listening to half of the shows. You have to go to the website to sign up, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the Elite tab. Signing up is $5. Every month, you'll get an additional show as well as access to the entire back catalog. There's probably over 200 shows over there now. Quite a bargain for only $5. If you have a story or something you'd like to share with us, you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call the phone number 817-945-3828. You can follow us on all forms of social media. And that's about all we have for this week's episode. Cam, what do you got planned for your week?
Just work. I don't think I've got anything crazy. You and I, we may have to go play some disc golf.
Yeah, man, I've been off too long.
I'll tell you what, too. Big shout out to the three new champs from the weekend. Whenever we watched the fights with George St. Pierre defeating Michael Bisping.
Wow,
we got TJ beating Cody and Rose beating Joanna. I didn't call any of those.
I didn't either.
I really honestly felt like the champs are going to defend it. And I 100% in all honesty, did not see, I did not see Rose beating Joanna the way she beat her.
I didn't either.
And I did not think St. Pierre was going to look as good as he looked.
I didn't think so either. I thought ring rust is a real thing. And I don't care how many push-ups you do, you're going to have trouble. And he didn't.
Yeah.
He looked good.
He looked real good. And then, of course, big shout out to our buddy James Vick from Fort Worth.
Yeah.
He ended up beating Joseph Duffy, TKO'd him in the second round. Man, it was great. It was just all around great. The fights over this past weekend were great. Look, man, Dustin Poirier ain't no joke.
No
man.
Joke.
And he put the stamp on it was a great fight, though. I mean, him and Anthony Pettis were fighting like crazy, the scrambles, the whole deal. I mean, that was the last couple of weeks have been a great round of fights. And a huge shout out to my buddy the Honey Sloth. I didn't have to get the tattoo, folks. He did get the win. He caught a guy in a steamer lock. I think he broke the dude's ankle. I don't know. It was a pretty brutal foot lock. They went back and forth a little bit, and then Dakota caught him. And then to my coach Dondi also tapped a guy with an steamer lock. The guy went for his feet, and Dondi is nasty with leg and foot locks. And when the guy dove for his feet,
he's
I'm like
Pajaris.
I'm like, don't do this, man.
Hudamir.
Yeah, because I'm like, Dondi wasn't initiating the foot attack. He was just doing his thing. And that dude went for his feet, and Dondi hooked that esteema lock on him, which is a type of ankle lock, folks, and tapped him with that whole deal. So both guys went over there. And then the group that we're kind of off of is another gym, you know, that we are umbrellaed under. They had six guys that fought that night too, or competed. I say fought, that rolled that night. And so they all won. So it was all a clean sweep for the whole group. So there was eight of them, I think, competed. Clean sweep for everybody. So it was a great night. A great night of grappling. Been a great night of fights. Played a little disc golf while you were gone. Now that you're back, we're going to have to go give it a whirl. Time for you to get that ace, baby. You got real close couple weeks ago.
Yep, it's going to happen. Now I'm getting into Christmas mode. Now that we're back, the vacation's over. I got to start getting Christmas lights. I got to get a new Christmas tree. I promised my wife we'd get a new tree this year. Last year, in fact, I threw the old one out. I mean, I threw it to the curb.
Why don't y'all go real tree?
We've thought about that. I don't know what we're going to do yet, but I know that that's coming. And, of course, the presents. I got to start getting the presents because it'll be here before you know it. I mean, Thanksgiving's in like 2 weeks.
Yeah, stop.
Your birthday?
No, stop.
Luke's birthday?
Yeah, stop.
It's here, man. The end of the year is approaching.
Yeah.
Well, everybody out there, have a good week. Don't work too hard. And for you elite members, we'll be speaking to you later this week. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hill.
Peace, yo.
That high.